Blog Talk Radio.
I stroll through the pictures, what I've left behind. You want again. I'm locked up in memories, they all intertwine. The memories in my mind. I know tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. You will never know what you've done.
Well, good evening and welcome to the Stop Child Abuse Now show, sponsored by NASCA, which stands for the National Association of Adult Survivors of Child Abuse. My name is Penelope Bennett. I am from Bellevue, Washington. And on my host team this evening is Pamela Lockridge. She is also a producer of the shows and an ambassador for NASCA. So Pamela and I are hosting you this evening. And tonight, the type of show is special guest night. So we have a very special guest this evening. And actually, I must say, our special guest, his name is Ross Stewart. Tomorrow, it is February 16th in Auckland, New Zealand. It's 2 p.m. in the afternoon. So as you may have guessed, our special guest from a different continent, and a little bit more about our very special guest in a few minutes. But I would like to first talk about NASCA and what NASCA is, and talk about NASCA's mission statement. If you're not familiar with NASCA, it is all about child abuse prevention, intervention, and recovery. We have a single purpose at NASCA to address issues related to childhood abuse and trauma, including sexual assault, violent or physical abuse, emotional traumas and neglect, and we do so with only two goals. The first goal being educating the public, especially as related to helping society get over its taboo of discussing childhood sexual abuse, presenting facts showing child abuse to be a pandemic, worldwide problem that affects everyone. The second goal, offering hope and healing through numerous paths, providing many services to adult survivors of child abuse, and information for anyone interested in the many issues involving prevention, intervention, and recovery. If you're streaming the show now and you are not sure, you might be interested in calling in, I would highly encourage you to do so. Pamela will greet you on the other line. You can call in at any time during the show. The number to call in is area code 646-595-2118. Again, the number is 646-595-2118. So before I bring on and introduce our very special guest and read a little bit from the bio that Ross provided to us, I want to tell you a little bit about how special guest night works. Our guest will have an opportunity to talk to us and tell us about his story. We start chronologically, so from the earliest memories up to the present day. We typically break the show up into three increments of about 20-25 minutes. The guests will tell us a little bit about their story, and then we will break to our panel, who will have an opportunity to ask our special guest, Ross, a question. And as many of us who are calling in on the panel are survivors, again, a friendly reminder to keep your comments and questions around our special guest, since this is his story and his show this evening. Speaking of our panel, two continents and at least 5 time zones represented. So our special guest, as I mentioned, is from Auckland, New Zealand. It is actually February 16th, 2 p.m. in the afternoon. We have Peter, a NASCA family member from Ontario, Canada. And we have Mary Ellen from New York, as well as Pamela, who's in Central Time, and myself. I'm actually normally on Pacific Standard Time from Bellevue, Washington, but I'm actually vacationing in Hawaii. So it's 3 p.m., almost a full day behind our very special guest. It's 3 p.m. in the afternoon on Monday, February 15th. So I'd like to tell you a little bit about our special guest, Ross Stewart, as I mentioned, from Auckland, New Zealand. He suffered various kinds of child abuse, both in and out of foster care. 18 months old, I was removed from my biological mother by the New Zealand DSW, which stands for Department of Social Welfare, and placed in foster care homes until finally ending up with a foster family that decided to adopt me at 7, says Ross. My memories of the various foster homes were of mostly psychological abuse, and some physical abuse, which consisted of beatings for bedwetting. These situations continued when adopted. Ross continues, at age 8, I was sexually abused by a neighbor's daughter who sodomized me and even raped me many times. I'm going to stop there, and I'm going to bring on Ross. Our special guest, Ross, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming on the show this evening and telling your story. Pamela and I both have our, obviously I have my microphone on and active, as is Pamela. And we are very interested in having you within your comfort level telling us your story from your earliest memory. And it looks here like your earliest memory seems like it was 18 months old. So maybe you can, if you're comfortable, fill us in from what you can remember from your earliest memory of your childhood.
Yeah, it was difficult because I never knew which set of parents I'd be ending up with or people I'd end up with. On a weekly basis, you were constantly being shifted around to different various homes because
may I ask why you were removed from your biological mother initially?
My biological mother married an American Marine who was stationed in New Zealand during the Second World War. And when he went back to the States after the war had ended, she couldn't cope with having a child as me. So she put me in a foster home. She was meant to go to the States with the chap she married, but she never did for some unknown reason. I don't know why. She never told me. So that's why I ended up in a foster home, and then she decided, well, she wanted a life of her own, so they put me up for adoption. And that took 7 years before that happened.
So you remained connected to her while you were in different foster homes until there was a decision to put you up for adoption.
Because that was the department's doing. Way back in those days, you were shifted around quite a lot because people sort of only held you for so long and then you were put into another home. I don't know what the procedure was with the department, but a lot of foster kids went through many homes in that era we were born in. It's just one of those things the department did. I don't know why they did it. I can't explain. They would never tell you anyway.
So this wasn't really your mother's decision, was it? Was the way they, the process that they followed in New Zealand at the time?
I didn't quite catch that.
Oh, so what, did your mother decide that she did, in fact, wish to put you up for adoption, or was that just the nature of the way the Department of Social Welfare did handle children?
The Department of Social Welfare in those days looked at the mother very closely, and what they would have suggested to her, I think they would have suggested to my mother, unless you put me up for adoption, because they knew her type of lifestyle, I would become a ward of the state, which means that the government would put me into government care and she would never see me again. So she had to agree to the adoption. I'm not sure if she wanted to give me up for adoption, but that's the way the department worked. They were like authorities to themselves. If they didn't feel like the parent was fit, they would put that child into a state, as they call them, state ward protection. And they would have threatened her with that.
Thank you for clarifying that for all of us who are on the panel and all of us listening in.
That's all right.
So you were moved around from foster home to foster home until you were put up for adoption?
Yep.
Okay.
I think I went through about 7 homes from memory before the last home. I was age 3, I believe, 3 and a half, and they decided that those people were going to first of all foster me, and then they decided to adopt me. I remember distinctly when I was placed in that home, I wouldn't take my coat off because I was scared that I was going to be left again with people I didn't know.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, that's heartbreaking.
I don't think any child should have to go through that. It's just horrific. But that's
absolutely.
That's the way it was in those days.
No,
now it's, I believe. Yeah, it's. I believe it's different now, where the even though you get put up for adoption, they call it an open adoption, where the biological parent has occasional meetings with the adopted person. They're not allowed to basically relinquish full control.
These are the types of things I just don't understand how a department that's supposed to be, you know, versed in everything, you know, involving the aspects of children in transition from an early age can actually, there's no sense of stability in any sense.
No.
You've got to understand
the Department of Social Welfare in those days were like, they didn't have to answer to anyone. They had their own set of rules. And you couldn't buck those rules. You had no say in it. They were like, I don't know, like a authority that took over your life and completely controlled it, whether you liked it or not. Maybe it's different on today's scale, but in those days it wasn't. It was like you were being controlled by the government and the department. They just did everything.
Yeah.
understand.
And yeah, this is Pamela. Yeah, Pamela, do you have any questions at this point for Ross?
Well, yes, I do. Thank you, Penelope. First, I have a comment. I mean, if you're looking at the way they were back then, and even so today still, I mean, it's a business model, you know? They have to do business, and however they have to do it to make it work, you know, they have to keep they kept the feelings out of it and just did it as a business, you know? You were a commodity that they had to handle one way or the other, you know? Your mother probably wasn't able to take care of you, you know, because of, you know, when your dad left. I don't know if she was able to get a job or I don't know if you know about that, whether she was able to handle, you know, the care, taking care of you. And if you went into the government, the government's just an entity. It's not a person. It's not you know, it's not compassionate. It's not about that, you know. It's about doing a job and getting a paycheck.
Yeah.
So I'm curious, Ross, if before you were adopted, and I know it was 3 and a half that you went to this final foster family, it sounds like, until they decided to adopt you. Do you have any positive memories of any of the other families that you were placed with before then?
No, none.
Okay.
It was so bad that as I grew older, I became more reserved within myself, and I. This is when the government re-stepped back and took control again, and placed me in a institution to sort what they called a disturbed child's behaviour out, and that's when it just didn't work, because the institution I was shipped into for 3 years. From the age of 9, it was worse, because you got physically beaten, you got punished in different forms, in different ways, depending on who the minder was or the teacher, and ended up being sexually abused again until the age of 13.
Okay, so to test my understanding, and I'm also reading from your bio here, just to make sure everybody else who's on the panel listening and it's clear. So, sounds like you were adopted by this family at age 7.
Yep.
And then while living with them at age 8, you were sexually abused by a neighbor's daughter.
Yep.
And then at age 10, you were sent to a special government institution for disturbed children, and there the abuse continued.
Yes.
Did anybody ever ask the question, kids act out, right, because they're acting out their trauma. They're traumatized. I mean, the bedwetting alone is an indication of abuse in a child.
No. No one ever asked us. Even when we were placed in this institution, you were treated as a problem child by everyone. And it was meant to physically sort us out with understanding, but because the staff weren't trained in this particular field, we suffered more so. I'm probably one of the ones who got off pretty lightly compared to some of the other kids who were at school. They went through far worse than some of the treatment I got. But that was then. You just couldn't say anything as a kid. You just had no one to tell. You couldn't tell your parents, because or your guardians what was going on, because you weren't believed.
Right. Of course. Right. Of course. You know,
so
are you okay, Roz? Can I break to the panel right now?
Yeah.
At this point, we have a couple other panel members that I'm sure have questions for you.
Yep.
All right. Pamela, did you have a comment or a question before I bring on Peter?
Well, yeah, it looks like you were with an adoptive family, and then you got sexually abused. Then you went to the government, and then you went back to your parents. So how do you say that? I mean, I'm still not understanding, but I'm sure as the show goes on, we'll understand. So I'm going to save that question, Melody.
Okay. I'm going to bring on Peter from Ontario, Canada. And Peter, good evening. You're on with Ross.
G'day, Ross. This is Peter from Ontario, Canada. I have a question, and also got have a question and a comment. First of all, I'm very deeply sorry about what you just mentioned, and I'm pretty much a former neighbor to you, to New Zealand. Anyway, I am from Australia, so.
Okay.
So, before I make a comment, but the question I wanted to ask, I think this might sound a little crude, rude in a way. What year did this happen? Do you know?
This happened in the 1960.
Oh, right. No, well, I know that I wasn't around by then. The question I want to ask: when your mum gave you up, is it because she couldn't afford keeping you, or it was just she didn't want to have nothing to do with you? What was the issue on that? If you did say it, I must not have heard.
I think she had two issues. She had a lifestyle which was you would probably call as somewhat not to one person. She would go out with several men at the same time. She married my father, who was a Marine, and he went back to the States after the war had ended. She was meant to follow him, but she never did, because she preferred her lifestyle. And I think somewhere along the line, she suffered some illness of some description, which had the department step in, because I had a brother who had run to the police station and said she was beating me, so the police stepped in, and that's why the department, the police handed her over to the Department of what we call Social Welfare, who took over the case, and I was placed in what they called state care under the department.
Yeah. So, another question I wanted to add on to that is that I know, because I've not quite been in the same situation, but did your mother ask if you wanted to live with your father, or, you know, or were you offered the opportunity to go and live with a relative or a sibling?
No, nothing like that at all. Apparently, what I can understand from the records is my father objected to because he was in the States. He'd put up a fight. He objected to me being for his being put up for adoption, and that was why it took from the age of 5 until 7 to finalise the adoption, because he was fighting it. But then the New Zealand government stepped in and told him either he backs off or they would prosecute him as for some on some grounds. I don't know what the grounds were. So at that stage, he backed off, and the papers went through without him having to sign anything or agree to it, because they said it was going ahead anyway, whether he liked it or not.
Right. And just a comment, I mean, I heard you say too, back in those days with the Department of Social Services, I mean, you were a kid, I was a kid, you know, like, I was awarded to the state of New South Wales, and then when I moved to Queensland, I had to have everything all transshipped to Queensland to be awarded to the state. Now, I was put in foster home for a short period, but I kept running away because of issues. But, you know, my mother and father put me in a situation, and my young sister, that we had to make a decision or have to make a choice who we wanted to live with. Now, from what I gathered or heard, that my grandmother said that social services, the Department of Social Services in Newcastle, they did come into it, but nothing happened. So I fully aware back in those days, from what I've heard, that the social services, the Department of Social Services, whether it's New Zealand or Australia, are pretty were much the same. So, but my heart goes out with you, mate. It wasn't fun back then.
Right. I think New Zealand social services in those days, you could class them on the same lines as Hitler's Germany. They were that type of people.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Thank you, Peter. Thank you, Peter. And appreciate your comments and your questions for Ross. I'm going to bring on Mary Ellen from New York. Mary Ellen, good evening.
Good evening.
And,
hi. It's very nice to meet you, Ron. Thank you for sharing your story with us. I certainly hope that the government and the Departments of Social Services are making lots of progress over there these days. I would hate to think that things were in that state still. Your story is very heartbreaking. I often think back when I was feeling for you to remember things, so I know that your memories.
Mary Ellen.
Yes.
Yeah, Mary Ellen, for some reason we are there. You went into very faint. Maybe if you wouldn't mind repeating that last sentence.
I'm sorry. I said, I'm sure that the memories from 3 and 4 years old are very significant and play a big impact even today on your interpretation of how things are in your life and where you're headed and what you've been through. I hope that somehow you can believe that your mother really just didn't have much control over the situation. That doesn't sound like it. It's almost like even if she was making bad decisions, she really, it was more out of government taking control of things. And I wondered if there's ever been any contact or trying to locate your father. It kind of sounds like he tried to stay in touch, but the government once again put a stop to that.
My father did try, and I've only just recently located my father and where he lived in the States, but he unfortunately passed away some years back due to a wound he suffered during the war as a Marine. So I never got the chance to meet him. I know he remarried and had some other children in the States, and I've been in touch with them. But I haven't met them yet, and I hope to do so as soon as this pandemic's all over and done and dusted. I hope to go and visit them in Indiana, where they live.
Good. Good for you. I'm really glad to hear that. I hope that goes well. Thank you for sharing all of this.
Thank you, Mary Ellen.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Mary Ellen. So, Ross, we had another panelist join us, another NASCA family member and ambassador for NASCA. Darlene from Tennessee, I'm just going to bring you on to say hello to Ross. I'm not sure how much of a story you've heard, but Darlene, you're on.
Hello. I'm sorry I'm late. Didn't get to hear much, unfortunately, but I'm here now. Better late than never, huh?
Okay. Well,
yeah.
Well, I'm here for you, all right?
Yeah.
Thank you, Darlene.
Thank you so much for
being back on. Oh, yeah,
well, thank you
for being here. So, Ross, Pamela and I are going to come back to your story. And so it sounds like even though you were adopted, and unfortunately after your adoption to this family, before you were actually sent to a government institution for disturbed children, you did experience and suffer sexual abuse by a neighbor's daughter repeatedly. And I didn't know if you wanted to make any comments about that before we went ahead chronologically in terms of your childhood.
The only comments I can make about it, I couldn't tell my at that stage it was my foster before I become adopted, my adopted parents, because of the standing of the daughter of the neighbor had in the community and the threats I was under, that she kept telling me what would happen to me. I was too scared. I was petrified to say anything to anyone. So I just bottled it up, and probably that's why I went. Basically, the department got re-involved again and decided to ship me out because they thought I was disturbed or wasn't coping with the life as a 9-year-old should be or an 8-year-old should be. I don't know what happened there. It was easier.
I'm sorry, did your adoptive parents have any idea that you were being sexually abused by the neighbor's daughter?
No. Even when I was at the school, the school never, or institution that I was sent to, never told them what had happened. When they finally found out what was going on, they never told the parents. They never told. No one ever knew anything about what went on at the institutions, because the government decided at that stage to put a court embargo on any information coming out about what had happened. And that wasn't lifted until 2010. And then it became public what had gone on at these two institutions.
It sounds like you had written in your bio that when you had gone and been sent to that special institution by the government for disturbed children, you endured more abuse, and it was by a man who was your dormitory housemaster.
Yeah, he wasn't a full-time housemaster. He was a relief housemaster. He was brought in two nights a week to relieve the permanent guy who was in charge. And every time he was on duty, or I got abused by him. So it was just this one guy.
Unbelievable. I mean, unbelievable. Just the environment, going from environment to environment. And absolutely, you were silenced. You were suffering in silence in a system that obviously does not advocate for children in a way that they should be advocated for.
No. We did. There's another pupil who was being abused as well. There were six of us in total who had been abused by this one guy. We did run away to the local police station in the local town and try to tell the officer what was going on, but the officer just said to us, we were from a school or a institution that was designed for special kids like us. We were prone to lying. We were prone to fabricating stories, and told us to go away, and nothing was ever done.
So you were labeled, and that was another way to stifle your voices.
Yep.
Darlene, do you have a question? Sorry.
The only time it came to light is when a department of, what was they called then, Department of Education, an inspector came out to the institution, and he mentioned to the chap who was heading the institution, he suspected by talking to some of us that something untoward was happening to some certain pupils. And then that's when all hell broke loose. Apparently it was an investigation by the school and by the a couple of government departments into this relief housemaster. And he just took off overnight, vanished overnight. But they never, ever told. One of the guys who was also abused, he came from the same district as I did, but he couldn't cope with it. In the end, he ended up committing suicide.
Oh, my gosh. Which is, you know, unfortunately, not unusual. Darlene, do you have a question? I'm sorry, Pamela, do you have a question for Ross?
Yeah. First of all, Ross, are you okay talking about this? Are you calm? And I just want you to take a deep breath and be calm about it. How does that affect you when he committed suicide? Did you think that was something you might want to do or not at the time?
It crossed my mind several times. Because I was constantly under the threat. The institution we were sent to was about, I don't know, 3 or 4 miles out of a local township. In such a deserted area, He would often come to you and threaten you. He had the ability to make either me or whoever he chose to disappear, and no one would ever know. Because in the district we were in, it was just miles and miles of nothing. It was just a building stuck in the middle of nowhere, basically. And if you run away, like I did several times, I got as far as the town before I was picked up by the local cops and shipped back to the institution. And there you were punished severely. You're locked in a duct. A room with no...
That's like
with no windows, no light, no nothing.
Let's take a break here, and
yeah,
I just want to applaud your I want to applaud your courage. It takes so much courage to tell the story. You're bringing a voice to that little boy who tried to have one who did not. That's justice. You know, you are finally serving, and we are listening. Your voice is being heard.
Yes.
You are bringing a voice to that little boy, and I can tell you, I know my NASCA family, myself, and speak for myself. I just am amazed and inspired by your courage, and I just wish to thank you. Thank you for telling us your story. It is such an injustice, the betrayal of the government, the betrayal of all the different adult entities that were supposed to protect you. I mean, it is, you can see I'm literally, my body's going numb a little bit, and I'm forgetting the name of my co-host. I'm just, we
Pamela.
Are here with you. We're, you know, I know Pamela, I called Darlene earlier. We're holding space for you. You know, we're standing with you, and you are not alone.
Yeah.
And you know, we all have different, slightly different experiences. There's so many similarities. And you have empathy. We know the pain. We know the pain of this abuse. So I just wanted to say, you know, you are inspiring and helping so many people right now who are listening into your story, and I just really have to commend your courage.
Thank you.
So Pamela, I think it'd be a good time to take another break, and Pamela, I wanted to give you an opportunity to have a few words with Ross before I invite our panel members back.
Ross, I'm an ICU nurse, okay? I also have a social work degree. I was sexually abused from the age of 4 to 18 by my mother's second husband, and he threatened me constantly with death. He would go out and put it hanging deer up because he was a hunter, and he'd go hang his deer up and split it from the bottom all the way through his chest. And then he'd tell me if I told anybody, that's what he'd do to me. And so, you know, as a little bitty girl from 4 to 18, living with this monster who also hid me in the corner, beat me with a belt, you know, just so many things. But I feel your pain, dude. I really do. And I want you to know your love here at NASCA, that you can call upon us anytime that you need us, and that, you know, I said in my book that I was living in a POW camp before POWs were even, you know, talked about. It was in the 60s, and I'm 63 now, and God has carried me through, and he will carry you through, and there is hope, and there is healing, and those tears you're crying right now are healing tears. We need to cry because we need to get the pain out. Right?
Yep.
Yep. Absolutely. There's nothing worse than being a child and living in an environment where you have absolutely no voice and no escape. You're imprisoned or you're punished for every time that you try and voice the injustices that are going on.
Right.
And I echo what Pamela said. I've walked in the same shoes. I was sexually abused by my biological father. From my earliest memory, I was 2 years old, 3 years old. and I was constantly silenced, and I didn't live a day without being in complete fear. So I know what that's like. And I applaud your courage again for speaking and telling your story. I'm going to bring on Peter. Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Ross. I'm going to bring on Peter. Peter, you are back on with Ross.
I'm speechless. I praise you, Rod, for coming out too. I mean, you know, I'm doing quite the heavy counseling over here because of my sexual abuse when I was living back home as a child in Newcastle by a family member. And if I didn't do what I was meant to do, there would have been consequences that was paid for, you know, molesting my own sister when I was a child, you know. But I was threatened by him. But, you know, I'm glad to hear another man come out to, I don't know if this is the right way of saying it, Penelope, is that, you know, it's good to have another male that I can have, give that support and have that support from another male, because, you know, the statistics is right there that 1 in 6 men, you know, that are sexually abused by parents or whoever, we stay hidden. Why? Because, you know, we're men. We're supposed to be strong, Rod. You know, we have to be the tough. We've got to be the tough ones, you know. It's like the Australians and the Kiwis in football matches. They're men. They've got to hit hard, and, you know, and that's the same way as for us, for people that have been abused. And I am virtually speechless about what you did share, but I do, you know, I do say, Rod, you know, I praise you, mate, for stepping up. It's actually good to hear a story from another male, because you know, Penelope backed me up on this, but there's not many
men. I don't want to interrupt you, but yes, Peter, you're totally. I mean, I couldn't have said it better myself. It is. Absolutely, and I hear this all the time. I've heard it from Bill Murray. I mean, we need more men to come on the show, yourself, Peter, Ross, to come out and speak their truth and talk about the abuse. Because,
I mean,
exactly. Because
the wrong way. I just don't want women to take it the wrong way around, that, you know.
No.
For us,
absolutely not. I think you're right. I mean, I think there is that stigma, right? Men are supposed to be tough and strong, and, you know, we know statistically the numbers are out there, you know, the facts are out there, Peter. So you're not saying that men don't they don't come forward. They're not as apt to come forward. And we know that the statistics, when we look at the numbers, right, we know that they're underreported. We just know they're underreported. But we do have facts and we do have numbers that support what you're saying. But you're absolutely right. It's hard for anybody to come forward. There is
and
a taboo, right?
It's heartbreaking.
But,
yeah, it's very heartbreaking. You know, I know Rod's position, with your position, Rod, I know yours is a little bit more heavier than what in my position. I mean, like with my cousin, more of an incestuous way. Like, I was lured when I was 6 years old, and then, you know, like I said, the consequences were paid if I didn't do well. You know, if I went to bed, you know, or, you know, there was consequences by him. Or if I didn't do anything to my sister, consequences would be paid for. So, you know. Oh, mate, you know, I wish I was, we have our wars in sport with the Aussies and the Kiwis, mate. But you know, you've got my heart. I'm right with you, mate. Right with you.
It's hard for a man to come out with what he's gone through, because as you say, we are meant to be men. We are meant to be strong. We are meant to be able to know what was right and what is wrong. But then to come out and you're thinking all the time, who is going to believe what happened? Who is going to believe that I went through so much, and no one, you just think no one would care, because the department didn't care, the people I was sent to the school didn't care. It seemed no one cared, so you had to live with it, and you had to sort of try and get on with what life you had, even though the institution was meant to help us. In actual fact, they ended up destroying us even more.
Can I ask you a question, Rod?
Yep.
Now, this institution's in New Zealand, right?
Yep.
Correct me if I'm right or wrong here, but I can't remember what year it was.
1960, the government decided to open one special institution for kids they saw as being troublesome or disturbed. Now, that institution ran from 1960 to 1970 until it was closed down for I don't know what reason it was closed down. And then transferred to another institution, a newer building or probably newer complex, some miles away on the other side of Auckland, until 1992. And that was then closed down by the Minister of Children and the Department of Social Welfare, because at that stage, what had happened at both institutions was becoming more and more harder to hide. So the minister stepped in and said that we were closing the institutions down for the safety and well-being of the children. And then they decided, it was only 4 years ago, basically, they decided to reopen these institutions and have another crack at it. And that's when I become involved in the Royal Commission into what went on. And I opposed anything, because I don't think anyone in New Zealand has the ability to cope with the children who are being abused. They just haven't got the expertise how to handle it.
Yeah, because correct me if I am right or wrong in it, but I was just saying to my wife while I was listening to you talk. Because when you were talking about this institution, because if I do recall, I mean, I didn't sit with my grandparents listening to it, but I believe it was on TV. It was sort of like on a current affair program, and it was based on the New Zealand and also on Australian institutions, the way kids are being treated in these institutions. If it's the one that I think, because I can't put the word together, but there was some kind of conflict in the way, you know, that people would say that you know, when a kid would go and reach out for help, that no one would believe, you know. And, oh, mate, I'm speechless. I'm with you all the way, you know. I don't know what more else. I mean, I've got goosebumps all over myself now.
Yeah. Thank you, Peter. Thank you, Peter. I mean, I Ross, I'll allow you to have an opportunity to respond to Peter, but I'm feeling gratitude.
Right.
I think looking back at it, and that's what I went through. Played on my mind and still does to this day. You can never forget is what happened. You can try and minimize the effect of it has on your life, but you cannot erase what has happened.
No.
That's why when I turned 18, I was allowed to live outside of my adopted parents. It was legal then to leave home. I decided I had a job offer from a Canadian company, and I immigrated to Canada thinking I could put all this behind me, which for a period of time I was successful at. But then it still comes back. There's news items or a radio or someone will say something, and your whole mind just goes back. You can't stop it.
No.
You try your hardest to stop it, but it just doesn't work. You end up in a screaming heap sometimes.
Yeah. Absolutely. It's true. But you're here, and you're telling your story. You're getting it out, and we'll you know, as we go through the story, more of your story after we finish with our other panel members about your healing process. But you're getting it out, and not only are you voicing your truth, you're not alone. You're adding your voice to a lot of different survivors of abuse, of child abuse, that maybe haven't been able to bring their voice and talk about what happened to them. You're not the only voice. Unfortunately, you're not on an island because there are a lot of people listening right now, and men included, especially men, they're saying, you know what, that happened to me too. And I've never said anything. I've never told anybody. And you're not, unfortunately, you're not alone, and you're giving them permission by speaking and letting it out. You're not only releasing it, but you're giving them permission to do the same, which is what makes telling your story so impactful. Ross. So, Peter, I wish to thank you for your comments, and I'm going to put you back on mute, and I'm going to bring on Mary Ellen from New York. And
hi,
Mary Ellen.
Yes. Boy,
you're
the
back
conversation.
With Ross.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes, okay. The conversation's been so intense, but I have to say I am so thankful that it's moving forward. I think you've done a wonderful job, and as they were saying, you are the voice for so many others who haven't been able to share their story, and even though it's extremely difficult, it's powerful, and I hope that you keep sharing your story. And when people don't want to listen, just keep talking and move on to another group if you have to, whatever. But us people here at NASCA, we will be supporting you. And something that I know I did when I first found NASCA, I didn't dare call in, I didn't dare talk, but I would go through the recordings and listen to so many people tell their story. And you'd be amazed how many people have, even though our stories are very different, we have similar ties. the secret, the abandonment, the threats, the constant danger and fear, and those things are ingrained in us. And learning that it's okay to let them out, and those that don't believe us are not worth our time. Your story is powerful, and it needs to be shared because there are other people going through things that need to heal, and they need to know that they can survive this. So I give you all the compliment, and certainly many, many blessings to you.
Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Mary Ellen, thank you. Thank you so much, and so beautifully stated.
Thank you.
I'm going to bring on Darlene from Tennessee. Darlene, you're on with Ross.
Hello, Ross.
Hello there.
I wanted you to know that you're very brave in what, coming forward and telling your story. Sometimes after we tell our stories, though, we feel like we might have said too much. Please don't let that sway you. You just tell it just enough. And if you ever feel like it's a little too much, just let us know. We don't have to talk about some things that you don't feel comfortable discussing. I think you're very brave.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Darlene. So I wanted to bring Pamela on just one more time, Pamela, just to make sure that I gave you enough of an opportunity to have any remarks for Ross before we continue on his story.
Ross, you're amazing for coming on. Is this the first time you've shared your story and been believed, or have you been believed before by somebody?
This is you're the third time, because I have had to go to two separate inquiries, one by the government department and one now by the Royal Commission, which has been set up to handle what went on under state abuse way back in the 60s and 80s. And at present, the Royal Commission is still going. But the only trouble with the Royal Commission of Inquiry is, although we've been heard and many people have come forward with what went on under state care, I don't think the commissioners, there's about five of them all up, have the knowledge or the ability to handle the inquiry sufficiently, or in a manner that doesn't re-traumatize the victim. Like in my case, when I was called before the Royal Commission, they called me on my birthday of all days to testify. Mm. And I would have thought they would have had the common sense to sort of say, well, that's, you know, we've got his details, we know when he was born, we know what he's been through, because basically we've got his records. They would have had a little bit more common sense and a little more compassion, even in the way they handled the inquiry or my interview, and I had to drive halfway across Auckland to get to the inquiry venue, which really I shouldn't have done, because in the back of your mind is, what sort of things am I going to be asked? Why am I going to be asked, why didn't I say something? Why didn't I try to stop it? Why didn't I voice my concern? Why didn't I go to someone? And that takes your ability to away from your me driving the vehicle, and not because I'm concentrating or thinking about what the commission is going to ask me, rather than I'm not paying full attention to the other cars on the road. That day I was desperately looking for a patrol car to help me because I knew I was in no fit state to be driving, and yet I had to do it. And I don't think they cared, because I had to drive after 4 hours of giving testimony. I had to drive back home again, and I was a total wreck.
So what do you think the purpose is of this commission? I mean, what is their end game? I mean, it's not to help you, evidently. It's to help themselves somehow.
The end game, is theoretically, is to give the government some suggestions how to prevent this ever happening again. It's happened. You can't stop what's taken place. But to prevent future generations of kids like me going through what we went through, they meant to come up with some suggestions or some ideas to prevent it from happening. But in actual fact, the longer this commission runs, and it's now been running over 18 months, and it's due to run another 18 months, I think, thereabouts, the more you get the idea that it's going to be sort of whitewashed over and sort of put on the back burner, and the government is going to sort of say, well, yes, we've got the commission's recommendations, but we've got more press. Like, I think this pandemic has come along at the wrong time, because they can use that as an excuse to push this to one side and shelf it while the pandemic's underway, and because the pandemic's more important.
Right.
I think it's the government's way of trying to find a way to get themselves off the hook from what they let happen.
That's what I was thinking too. And they don't know the deep pain and suffering that you really went through. So really my thing is, take care of yourself, Ross. You know, seek out trauma-based help, therapists that can help you, because they're going to do what they're going to do no matter what, and they don't care for the individual. They're just trying to, you know, whitewash, like you said. So just make sure that you're in a safe place mentally and physically and, you know, emotionally. Just make sure of that.
That's all I can do. That's all anyone can do.
Right.
That's so really
good
advice.
Are you seeing a therapist? Are you seeing anybody for your emotions, you know, to help you through this mentally? Are you seeing a professional?
I'm seeing a counsellor once a week, which the government's paying for. But I've been doing that now basically for probably 9 months. It's some days it's not easy. Some days I've come out of a counselling session and I thought I can't cope with this anymore, and I just about stepped in front of a car. And then at the last second, I said, no, I can't put that driver through it. I cannot allow myself to kill myself by using some form.
Absolutely not. If you're having those kind of thoughts, Ross, you need to check yourself into the hospital for sure, for real. Yeah. Like I said, I'm a social worker. The first thing we ask any client is if they want to hurt themselves or hurt somebody. If you're thinking about hurting yourself, you need to check into the hospital, the mental facility, and tell them about your ideation and get you help.
Yeah, it's only happened once, and thank God I didn't go through with it, because I just I knew I couldn't. I couldn't go through. I couldn't put someone else, its life, in trouble because of my stupid act.
Thankfully,
I come to my senses.
And your worth. It's not about, and it's not only about the other driver, although that just shows how, sensitive and caring you are. But it's also your worth living and your worth being here. We are now, believe it or not, Ross, we have a little less than 20 minutes left of the show. It's a 90-minute show, but it does go by very quickly, believe it or not, we start telling our story and we get into the discussion. And so we are in the last segment, and we're talking about now where you are today and in your healing process. And I'd like to hear about how you initiated the therapy. But I guess I did want to interject a comment and let you know that one thing I realized when I started my healing process, and that was I was 46, that was four and a half years ago, is that because we've never really talked about our trauma, when you go through healing, it's almost like you have to bring it all out, right? And sometimes you're speaking of these things for the first time. Sometimes we numb ourselves during the trauma, so we're actually experiencing the emotion, everything that goes around with the reality of it for the first time. I found, and I've heard a lot of other survivors say, the healing was even more painful than the abuse, but that's because you're addressing it for the first time. So the pain that you're feeling, for me, I kept reminding myself, I'm feeling pain because I'm healing. It's progress. Like with Pamela, we all go through, right? The ultimate numbing of the pain isn't to stop it all. But you said it happened once, you're moving forward. The pain of healing is actually, to me, meaning you're moving forward in life. You're moving through the healing process. I wish someone had explained that to me when I first started, because I didn't figure that out for a couple of years, but that my pain was a sign of progress because I had stifled and kept it in for decades. So with that being said, if you wish, in the last segment, just talk a little bit about where you are today in terms of moving forward.
I think every day is getting somewhat easier than the past years, because I can actually pick up a paper or listen to a news item without getting as upset as I used to be, especially when it comes to kids being abused. It's easier, but the thoughts never leave. They just, like, I'm ultra careful. I'm still ultra careful when I'm talking to people that I know, because I'm on guard that they could possibly say a word that will re-trigger me back to those memories. So you become... I become absolutely sort of over cautious what subjects I discuss with anyone, or if I see a discussion heading in a way that I feel might re-trigger me, I'll cut it short and just move along and move away. I don't know whether, I remember recently walking out of a situation where I felt really so uncomfortable about the way the meeting was going. I thought, I can't do this. I've got to get out of the situation, and I left. And I. they contacted me later and said, you know, why did you leave? And I said, because I just didn't feel it was right. Something was bugging me, and I couldn't put my finger on it. And I said, what was the discussion or the meeting about? And they turned around and said they had brought in three people to discuss children abuse. And I just said, well, I had to walk out. I wouldn't have been able to cope with that. And luckily, my my feelings sort of clicked onto something wasn't right. And the best way to remedy it was to remove myself from that situation. And I'm glad I did, because I just would have gone to pieces.
Have you heard of the concept, because this is something that I did in therapy, my therapist kept saying, you know, you're reparenting yourself. You're reparenting yourself. So it sounds to me, I don't know if you've heard that concept or not,
right,
but there's an adult in you that's protecting, right? It's those protections, right? Not subjecting
yep.
you to something that could be painful, and you're honoring your intuition. And I hear you tell that, and to me it's like, that's awesome. You know, you're advocating for yourself. You didn't, you know, you thought you might, you were sensing, you trusted your intuition that you're going to be in an upsetting situation, and you protected yourself from it. I commend you for that. You're getting now the protection that you didn't have when you were a child. You're giving it to yourself. You don't have to sit in a room and be abused or be afraid. You know, you're giving yourself permission, and you're nurturing yourself, and you're taking yourself out of it. I hear that, and I think, wow, that's awesome.
I can also remember, as a 14-year-old, the last time I was abused by this housemaster, he for some unknown reason, I was part of the swimming team of the institution, and we were taken to from the institution to a major Olympic swimming pool where we'd do races against other schools or other institutions or other private institutions. And for some reason, the coach who we had from our institution couldn't take us, so he ended up being taken by the housemaster, relief housemaster. And I remember sitting in the stands waiting for my race to come up, and he was telling me what he planned to do with me in the future. And I just panicked. I just couldn't do it. I just stood up and I said, I can't race. I can't do it anymore. And I remember racing to the changing room and changing back into my clothes as fast as I could and just crying. Because this guy had told me things I'd never heard, and I don't think I would want to go through them. And that's the last time I ever got abused, because apparently at that stage the school had found out what was going on, had called him the next morning after and confronted him, and he just took off, vanished. We never saw him again.
Awesome. Good.
Wow.
You stood up for yourself.
That's right. You had enough. You were done. So, Ross, we have 10 minutes left of the show. And if it's okay with you, what I'd like to do is bring on our panelists one more time for about a minute or two each, just to, you know, have a few, you know, final, you know, words with you. Regarding your healing process before we close out the show. So I'll bring on Peter first, Mary Ellen, Darlene, and then Pamela. Is that okay with you?
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm going to bring on Peter now. And Peter, you're back on with Ross.
G'day, Rob. It's Pete here again from Ontario.
Yep.
I'm going to put you in my prayers and thoughts, mate. I mean, that's all I can do. I mean, you know, I And I agree what you said to Penelope about, you know, about us adults holding on to that our inner youth or inner child. I'm still carrying that inner child to try and reach out for the love that I never got when, you know, because our parents are supposed to nurture us and protect us. But what you said, Penelope, makes a lot of sense, and to you too, Rod, is that, you know, as far as protecting ourselves, especially us males, you know, and I'm not going against here with women, but with the males, it's, we've got to do whatever we have to take to protect ourselves, and I commend you, Rod. Blessings to you, sir. You know, my prayers and thoughts. I would just say, hang in there, mate. You know, I know that's easy said and done, but you're not alone. I'm with you all the way. If that's all right, I might be a kangaroo, but kangaroos like the Kiwis as well. So I'm with you all the way.
Yep. It's hip for your underarm bowling practices.
Yes.
Thank you, Peter. Thank you so much for coming on tonight, being a panelist, being, you know, just such a great, you know, member of the shows and in terms of your contributions and being a member of the family and support, your support of Ross tonight. So thank you. Sorry, I just put you on mute. That's a. Sorry about that.
It's all right.
All right, Peter. Thank you, Peter. Okay, I'm going to bring on Mary Ellen. Mary Ellen from New York. If my finger will work on my computer, there we go. Mary Ellen, you're back on with Ross.
Okay, I don't want to take too much time, but I want to say, I've been hearing lots and lots of growth and progress, so I don't want you to be discouraged. I was listening to you say how you're going to counseling once a week for 9 months. That is amazing. It's amazing that you are sticking with it. Every week is progress. I'm so proud of that. I want you to keep doing that. And you know, that's a place to open up and share. Just make sure you're at a safe spot when you leave. Sometimes asking your therapist to make sure you do a calming relaxation before you head out will be helpful. I wanted to say I'm very proud of you walking out of the company meeting. That's self-protection. That's something that you need to do. I'm grateful to hear you say you did it. Do not criticize yourself. And I cannot imagine the difficulty of attending that hearing, but wow, how powerful. You may not think it had an impact, but I want you to know that those words had to be documented legally. And even though you might not see the impact now, they have to acknowledge that, and in the future, that's evidence that will be used if somebody else has ever files a claim for being hurt. You know, they've been warned, and they have to acknowledge there has been cases brought forward. So you have done an amazing piece of work right there. Hang on to all of that, please.
Thank you.
And I'll keep praying for you.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Oh, thank you, Mary Ellen. I agree with everything you said. Thank you so much for being on the panel this evening and your support.
Thank you.
I'm going to bring in Darlene from Tennessee. Darlene, you're back on with us.
Hello, Ross. You are now a brother. You're now my NASCA brother.
And welcome to the family. And if you look me up on the contact page, you'll see Darlene J. Clark. Feel free to contact me if you need or wish just to talk to somebody, all right?
Yeah.
Thank you. And Peter is a big asset, not only here, too, but he's also in that the meetings on Sunday, Tuesdays, and Thursdays sometimes. So maybe
right.
You'll come to him and get to meet him there as well. You know, there's another meeting tomorrow at 1 Central Time.
Right.
But you are strong. But you are strong and you are courageous. No more beating yourself up because that was done enough to us, you know?
Yeah.
That's right.
You don't deserve it. But thank you so much for sharing your story.
That's all right. Thank you.
Thank you,
Darlene. That's a great reminder. We do have group recovery meetings Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Sundays, 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. So I'm going to bring Pamela back on. We're at 3 minutes and 30 seconds. So Pamela's got about a minute with Ross.
Hi, Ross.
Yep.
Do you depend on faith? Do you have a faith-based relationship with any higher power?
I have my own faith in God. Although I'm not a frequent churchgoer, I deal with God in my own way.
That's right. Personal relationship.
Yeah.
Okay. All I got to say to you, in a twinkling of an eye, it'll all be changed. So the suffering we're going through here on earth is finite. Okay? That's what I want to
yep.
leave you with. It's finite.
Yep.
It's temporary.
Right.
And I'm here for you. Penelope's here for you. Darlene or Peter, you can get in touch with us. All you have to do is just reach out, okay?
Yeah. Okay, thanks.
Thank you, Pamela. That's absolutely right.
Yes.
Thank you. And, you know, Ross, we've got about 2 minutes left. I will give you the last minute and a half, but what I wanted to say is I agree with everyone. You're making some huge strides and progress in your healing. Coming on the show and telling the world your story, that's there's a little boy in there that wants to be heard and wants everybody to know and is advocating for himself. So you've taken a huge leap by coming on the show, not only for yourself and for that little boy, but for so many others who were so terribly mistreated and abused as children. You have now inspired them. You've never given them a voice as well and permission to do the same. So with that, Ross, if you'd like the last minute to say a few words.
All I can say is I hope whoever has gone through abuse of any description has the courage to speak out, come out and tell the world what happened in your life. Because otherwise, it's never going to ever go away. Although it won't ever leave me, the more people that know what went on or what goes on in the world, it's got to stop. At some point, someone's got to listen and protect children of the future better than what we were protected by or lived under. It's my only reason, really, for coming forward, is to protect the future generations that they not have to go through what we went through. Otherwise, it's for nothing. And the more people who come out and talk about it, the better.
And you did that this evening, Ross. Thank you. You did. And appreciate your final words and appreciate you being here this evening
and sharing your story with the world. That does conclude our show for this evening. On behalf of the National Association for Adult Survivors of Child Abuse, we thank you for being on the panel, interacting with our special guest. We thank you for listening. And to close out, if you see something, as an adult, if you see something, say something. Thank you.
Yep.
And good night.
Yeah, good night. Thank you.
Blog Talk Radio.